Hello, it is September 15th, 2014. You are looking live in Athens, Georgia. This is episode 447 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. It is Sunday afternoon. The city of Athens is still in mourning. I have a friend here who is a minister, a preacher, man of God, and he says that nothing really affects turnout as much as whether Georgia wins or not. He's not even a Georgia fan, and he roots for him. Anyway, so Georgia lost in a very difficult, please give the ball to Todd Gurley when you have first and goal from the 4-yard line game. So basically it rained all day today, and it wasn't even supposed to. That's just what happens when Georgia loses around here. And I suspect today's guest is someone who will be able to understand that quite acutely, much better than I can, as a matter of fact. I am delighted to have on today Paul Feinbaum. He's the host of the Paul Feinbaum Show on ESPN Radio and author of the excellent book, My Conference Can Be Your Conference, Can Beat Your Conference, which is available where all books are sold on Amazon and other less morally reprehensible places. Anywhere you want to buy the book, you should buy it from HarperCollins. It's edited by my friend David Hershey. It's a terrific book. Paul Feinbaum is a very fascinating man and a fun guy to talk to, and here he is. All right, first off, Mr. Feinbaum, thank you for taking time out. I always wonder what you do on Sundays after you have a busy full college football Saturday. What do you usually do on Sundays?
Really pretty quiet. In my previous life as a writer, I would get up early and pound away. Now that has slipped away from my life, I get up and just kind of catch up. I'm usually gone for a couple of days in football season. And really don't do much. I still read to a couple of newspapers, believe it or not, and then my wife and I usually head out to lunch after we jog or do something that sounds athletic but really isn't, and come back and read, and I'll catch a couple of minutes of an NFL game during the afternoon, and then, like everyone else, watch football at night.
So one of the things, and I loved your book, and I'm not just saying that because David Hershey would electrocute me if I didn't say that. I do love the book, and one of the things I really have like about the book, and have generally liked about your career, and I'm curious what your thoughts about this in a macro sense is. It seems to me one of the things, when I started Deadspin kind of got going, it seemed that the place it was filling was most of the sports reporters, sports writers, either television or print, that I knew of never actually talked to fans. They usually just talked to other reporters or talked to other people. And your career really seems to have obviously you bring a lot to the table, but it does feel like you. People now, I'll see television people and they'll be like, wow, I can't believe all these horrible things people are saying on Twitter or what's in the comment sections of my story. But you've been seeing this for years, and I think it's given you a natural kind of understanding of maybe how the fan brain works.
Well, it started, the genesis of all this is being a reporter and a columnist, particularly after I was a investigative reporter early in my career. The newspaper simply couldn't afford to keep me in that role because of lawsuits. They made me a columnist so they could hide behind Times versus Sullivan. And as a columnist, particularly in the 80s, when I started my career, you had to deal with people because there was no Twitter, there was no email, even talk radio. So people would call you on the phone. You get to the newspaper office and they start screaming at you. And I said, this is really kind of cool. So then I would just write the next column. I learned this trick from Jim Murray, by the way. I would just see who I could take off next week. Murray used to write a column. He would write a bad column about Indianapolis and then and say it's the worst town I've ever been to. And then he'd write an apology and say, I was wrong. I really didn't mean to say Indianapolis was the worst town. Detroit's the worst town. So he worked his way across the country. And I started playing around with that, and I started getting amazing reaction as a columnist in a city, in a state where football was sacrosanct. And that morphed into talk radio in the late 80s and into the 90s, and at that point, I began sensing that there was an untapped group of people out there who didn't have a voice, who wanted one, and quite frankly, as football stadiums locked out the average guy in college and obviously in the pros. They needed somewhere to go, so they came to talk radio, and now they're pretty much on Twitter and social networking. But so I did have, I know it's a long answer, but that's how I really became engaged. And it also had something to do with the fact that I spent most of my career in Birmingham, Alabama, which didn't have anything else. There wasn't a pro sports team or even one that we cared about. So the fan, and by the way, when you're in Birmingham, you don't get the A-list like right. you do at ESPN or some other network. So I had to find a way to make a living on the radio, and it just happened that it was talking to the average Joe every day and letting them become the star.
You know, I kind of love this idea because, of course, every writer I know, about myself included, often complains about getting yelled at on Twitter all the time. But I am going to start to – I may actually set up a program to have maybe a robotic voice call me and say those things to me over the phone, and suddenly just like being able to like passively ignore them. But I guess people are meaner online than they are. But like, even when someone calls you to yell at you, I think there's still a I'm talking to another human being notion that maybe isn't there online.
No, you're right, and there is a give and take, and most people, when they talk to you in real time, are shocked that you will listen to them, and when they stop screaming, and you, if you're passionate, and sometimes I would yell back, but I quit doing that as I got a little bit older, but social networking is just unbelievable. I've had a couple of interesting experiences with it. Well, last year, I was on game day for the first time, and yeah, you know, I wasn't like a major player. I mean, I'd go out and have 30 to 40 minutes between my next hit, so you really don't have much else to do. so you just kind of grab your phone and start reading. And the very first week I was on, I mean, I got back in, and it was massive. I mean, get this guy off my screen, you know, F word this. He's the ugliest person I've ever seen. He's a dweeb. He looks like my eighth grade history teacher. He's from another planet. And at some point, I mean, do you start to cry?
Don't cry.
Or do you say, you know what, I really don't care. But I do it because it does toughen you a little bit, and you never, and this is my feeling on it, I never react. Because you just can't. Yeah. Now, I realize a lot. Most people do react on Twitter, and that's maybe part of the fun. I don't do it because, to me, it's just, there's nothing wrong with it, except I think it's just better for me just to read it and laugh, because I see the same thing every week. I cannot tell you how many times, and for those who have never seen me, I'm a guy in my late 50s, you know, I'm balding. And I bet the line "face for radio" has been said, issued with me, you know, 4 trillion times.
Sorry, we had a video thing there pop up there. So I'm curious now. When I want to ask you then about the change of ESPN with the idea of ESPN, and because I think I remember what you talk about this in the book, but one of your big. Commentaries last year was Lane Kiffin, was when you did the Lane Kiffin, compared him to Miley Cyrus. I was actually, I think that was in Athens. I was standing about 5 feet away from you, actually, I think, when you did that. And it's funny, though, because I'm curious, you write about in the book, you actually use the phrase the power of proximity, and how it's a little different to say things out in the world that and on television, then, like, you know, when you're in the radio, you're in your own little booth. I find this online too. When I'm writing, I'm just at my computer, no one's around me, and then later people see it. But on one hand, you want to stand behind your convictions and this is what I said and I mean it. But on the other hand, it is different when the person that you're talking about is either in the room or someone you'll be talking to pretty soon.
Well, the thing about Lane Kiffin, not to get heavily deep into the backstory, but that was originally supposed to be a piece I was going to do on game day 2 weeks earlier, and it got cut at the last second, and it came back up again the weekend we were in Athens for the LSU game, and I had it came up at the meeting before. They wanted to ask me about the quarterback situation in Southern Cal. I'm thinking, I live in Birmingham, Alabama. I mean, I don't really know if I feel that comfortable, talking about what's going on. So when they asked me the question, I told Lee Fitting, the executive producer, I said, I really would rather go into Kiffin per se. And so Chris Fowler asked me the question, and I had actually written it out. I had the flu that week, and again, I'm nervous. I'm on game day, and everything's supposed to be organic and natural on game day. But I was sitting in Athens, and I looked down at my card, and I had this big finish, and I just couldn't take my eyes off the card. And one of the lines was, you know, how did Lane Kiffin ever get to where he was? This guy is the Miley Cyrus of college football. And I said at the end, I said, when he gets fired, which he will, I hope SC hires an adult. Well, I said that. You were there with David Hershey, and a couple of hours later, SC loses. I think they were at Arizona, and Kiffin gets fired the next day, and that becomes an eruption.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing about working for ESPN, I mean, if you say something on ESPN, it's going to get some coverage. And the next morning, I flew back to Birmingham, where my wife was still living, and I got up about 6:30 to let the dog out, and I had like 19 calls from SportsCenter. I didn't even know it. I finally listened to the message, and they said, "We need to talk to you about Lane Kiffin." I flipped on the television, and the breaking news: Lane Kiffin had been fired. Well, that's, you know, that's one thing. So I talked about it all day. Well, 2 weeks later, I'm going to Seattle. Washington's playing. I think it was Oregon. And I'm told that Lane Kiffin will be making his first public comments. I'm like, oh, my goodness, I'm going to have to face this guy. And I really, I didn't know. I got blamed for him getting fired. Now, did I have anything to do with it? I don't know. Certainly, you know, calling for somebody's firing on game day carries a little bit of weight. And when you lose a game, fans gravitate. So he walked in the room. It's like 4:45 in the morning Pacific time, and I just walked over to him. I said, "Lane, Paul Feinbaum." He said, "Like, yeah, I know who you are." "You got me fired." I go, "Oh, okay, well."
Okay, so this is what he thinks.
And he did his interview, and afterwards, again, we're hanging out because there's nothing to do, and we start talking. And I'm not saying we were like magnets, but we really started getting into it. The next day, he sends me a text saying, "Hey, by the way, I just listened to Wrecking Ball by Miley Cyrus, and it's fantastic. I'm glad you turned me on to her."
Look what you've done.
Over the course of the fall, we started talking quite a bit, and that's what. And listen, I grew up, as I said, in a small market. I didn't think. I mean, Lane Kiffin's not talking to me because he thinks I'm a nice guy. He's talking to me because I work for ESPN. And then the next thing you know, he goes to work for Nick Saban, which I found just utterly amazing. I know I'm giving you book answers for
no
questions, but that's kind of what happens when you work for the network, and what you say really does matter. You don't have to go, "Hey, you think somebody saw that?"
Yeah.
Although I will tell you one story about that, and I'm still naive, so. Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to believe that there are actually 2 million people watching every week and that people are starting to get to know me. So we're in Clemson in the middle of the year. It's the FSU game. And the guest picker is Bill Murray. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, I grew up a huge Bill Murray fan, you know, on Saturday Night Live and, you know, everything he did after that. So I walk back to the bus after my hit. And I walk in, and there's Bill. He was going to do this famous thing later with Corso.
Yeah, but he body slammed him or something, didn't he? Yeah.
So I'm kind of walking over toward him because I'm thinking, I mean, this is my one and only shot to meet Bill Murray. And as I walk over to him, he says, "Paul, how you doing?" I'm like, "Huh?" And, you know, we talked for a few minutes, and he finally asked me, he said, he didn't really mean it this way, but he said, how did you get hired? And I'm kind of looking around, and I mean, what he really meant is, I mean, you're not Kirk Herbstreit, and I started giving him my backstory. He was fascinated by the writing part, and, you know, what do you say? "Hey, I really like you in Ghostbusters." And finally, I ran into Gene Wojciechowski a couple of minutes later, and I said, "Gene, you're not going to believe Bill Murray knew who I was." He looked at me and said, "Are you kidding? You think, Paul, you were just on television in front of 2 million people. That's how he knows who you are." Those things never really dawned on me, and to some extent still don't.
I guess I'm curious about that too. If it's changed you, I mean, like you've got Tim Tebow taking pictures of you while sleeping and putting it on Instagram. You've got you make a slight comment about South Alabama being a little bit better, and all of a sudden there's a meme that there's a rumor that Feinbaum picked South Alabama or Mississippi State. Spurrier's calling you out after games. Does it change the way you do the show? Or are you just more aware of it while you're doing it, or is it something that you become more aware of when it's over?
No, I mean, you really can't stop. I mean, listen, there are people who do think about this all the time and expect. I was at the Rose Bowl last year, and I very similar thing. And I walked back into the truck, and there's Magic Johnson. He says hello to me. By then, I'd kind of realized he probably saw me on television a minute earlier with my name under it. But no, you don't. Although I will say the Spurrier thing was funny. I picked South Carolina to win the game against Georgia. It was a very last minute thing, and then I get home and I'm looking at Twitter last night, and Spurrier blasts me for picking Georgia by 25. And I actually reacted to it. It's one of the few times I just put on Twitter, because I knew there would be. I said, by the way, I did pick South Carolina to win, and I got a note from Lee Fitting, and he said, you never brag about the games you got right. Lee Corso has a line. He said, when you miss a big game, you say little, and when you get it right, you say less. And that is a good mantra to live by, although I felt like in this case, yeah. I didn't pick Georgia right. by 25.
You want to clear the record. Right.
And by the way, nobody cares.
Right.
I mean, absolutely no one cares who anyone in this country picks in the game other than Lee Corso. I was with Tim yesterday in Gainesville, and everybody's, oh, who am I going to pick? The average fan, it just doesn't make any difference. I found myself, I said, why am I trying to correct something that has got me national attention? but it's just one of those things, there's a natural instinct to want to do it and to be right.
But for the actual production of the show, I mean, like, because you've gone from small markets and now you're national, you don't find yourself being like, oh, I better say something more controversial, or I better rein it in a little bit. Is it still just when you're actually doing it, does it still feel like the same show?
I will say, working at ESPN, there's a little bit of a person in the back of your mind saying, "Be careful." I think that would be, it wouldn't be. I'm not sure that's only ESPN. I think there's a lot of that out there. But I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I mean, I got in trouble last year. I made a very innocent comment. I thought Spurrier. Here we go with Spurrier again.
He's the guy.
He had blasted Jadeveon Clowney, and someone asked me about Clowney. Didn't play in a game, and the doctor said he was good to go. I think it was against Kentucky, and I came out on Monday on ESPN and said, "I said this guy. I don't know what the deal with him is. I said he's become the biggest joke in college football." And the next thing you know, it was tweeted by SportsCenter. It was played by, and I'm trying to explain something that I said, and once you say it on a major forum, or really anywhere for that matter nowadays, you can't walk it back.
Yeah.
And I tried to explain it, and I found myself talking to the wall. Once it's out there, it's out there. And, you know, it's a cliche now to own it, but frankly, you're better off just owning it and moving on, because you'll never talk your way out of something you've already said.
You know, I know that you used to, there were times that you read about this in the book about, you know, actually spending some time with listeners and spending meeting them, sometimes being scared, but mostly, like, you know, recognize them as normal people. Is that harder to do on the national platform? Is it different now being in Charlotte than Birmingham? How has that changed, if at all?
Well, it is different here because, this is a city that, you know, I don't know, have you ever met anybody that actually was born in Charlotte?
I know lots of people that live there, but no, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, everyone's here from somewhere else, right. And yeah, in a way it's good, though, Will, because, I mean, you spend so much time in the same place, and you think everyone really cares about college football, and you come to a city that's a banking community and people from all over the country, if not the world, and they really don't. I think sometimes it's good to have to explain what you do, because when you are at a national working for a national platform, whether it's Deadspin, whether it's New York Magazine, whether it's The Times, you know, you're appealing to people from all walks of life, and you just can't assume they know what you're talking about. And but if you're in Birmingham, you assume you don't have to explain everything. It's a foregone conclusion. So it's really been a good experience for me, because I think whenever I say something on the air, I make sure if you don't have a southern drawl and have pork rinds in the back of your truck, you may not understand exactly what the point is.
Yeah, I've certainly found this because I just moved to Athens last summer. I've just been here more than a year, and I find that I would tell people here because one nice thing is not living in New York City anymore. Nobody cares at all that I'm a journalist or I'm in the media at all. It's just like, oh wait, so you're the guy that's at home all the time, so you don't have a job? I'm like, no, I work out of home. I don't go in an office. It's an entirely different thing. But I've noticed too that like when I tell people I'm a sports writer, the main thing like of course they just, not only do they only want to talk about Georgia football, they cannot understand how I could be a professional sports writer covering national events who can't tell you who the fourth string tight end on Georgia is. Like
No.
I'd say it's a failure of my profession. And I'm curious, I hang out with the people here, I'd be remiss. You know, there's a section in your book where you talk about Mark Richt, and you talk about like basically three plays that have cost him from winning, from really breaking through and winning that national championship at Georgia. I'm curious, was not giving the ball to Todd Gurley on first and goal from the four yesterday a fourth one?
Yes. I mean, Georgia to me was at least a contender for the national championship, and I think that's pretty well gone away now. I mean, listen, their schedule is still okay, but yeah, Mark Richt's going to be one of those coaches that whenever his career ends, and there's some Georgia fans who would like to see that sooner rather than later this today, he'll I think he'll always be haunted by Aaron Murray on the 4-yard line in the Georgia Dome. It's early to say. It's too early to say about the game in Columbia. Although I really, think Georgia fans will argue about the spot. I mean, they'll argue about all these things, but when the sun comes up, it's going to be Mark Richt couldn't win the big game. And I as one who once thought he was not the right person for Georgia, I really do like him now and admire him. But does he have that killer instinct? I mean, you can never. I mean, it's hard to criticize a guy who tries to pass his way to a touchdown. But this was the time when you have the best running back in America. I mean, everybody watching knew what he was supposed to do,
Are
and he
you?
didn't do it.
I'm curious. What is your watching environment on Saturday? I know I've done some stuff for Fox Sports, and I've been there when they have like you're in the green room and there's eight televisions. But I find it just means I have no idea what's going on in any of them, as opposed to having a better idea of what's going on around the nation. What's your viewing experience like on football Saturdays?
It changes from week to week because, this year I'm doing the SEC Nation show. I'm still doing the hits for game day where, I mean, you spend a couple of days someplace and then you have to decide, are you going to stick around? Like I was in Gainesville yesterday. The show's over at noon, the game's 7.5 hours later. And with all due respect, do I really want to spend 7.5 hours in Gainesville waiting for the Kentucky game?
Understood.
So I did what any intelligent person would do. I got to the airport as fast as possible. And then I flew back, and you get back, and you start. I mean, the problem with games now, and it wasn't as bad last on the third week, but the second week there must have been nine games going on at the same time that I wanted to see. So it becomes almost fruitless to try to keep up with everything. So I mean, Twitter is a great way to keep up with everything while you're walking the dog. So I'll try to chill out a little bit. The next week I'm going to Alabama for the show, and I will go to that game. I mean, you try to go to a couple of games, although having come from a career where you had to go to every game, it is nice to pick and choose. But the worst place to keep up with a game, and you know this, is at the game, because people don't watch football anymore in a press box. They read Twitter. I mean, if I dare you to walk in any NFL or college football press box this fall and find one person actually watching the game. They're just watching to see what everyone else is saying about them about the game, and but that's the world we live in. I mean, you go to the beach and you're walking and everybody's reading and their iPads. I mean, no one's actually relaxing anymore. Something's wrong with the world. Although I'm with everyone else. I mean, I'm keeping up with all this stuff while I'm working during the middle of shows, let alone when I'm not.
Yeah, I feel like I should have gone to college to become a pickpocket. Like people's attentions are so, it would be so easy now. I could just be like, it would be a master thing. Oh, okay, just a couple more things before I make you do some fun trivia stuff for us. I'm a Big Ten guy. I went to the University of Illinois. Do you have pity for the Big Ten?
I'm starting to, and one of the things about this book that Wojciechowski and I did, the original premise was the SEC versus the Big Ten. This And that, by the way, that was only a year and a half ago that we began the project. So you can tell how quickly that has gone off the board. I really don't pity the Big Ten because they are such an arrogant group collectively. No, not in Champaign. Okay?
Well, there's nothing to be arrogant about in Champaign.
No. But I mean, I had this weird experience last year to actually do a game day from Evanston. I mean, you know, that had never happened, and obviously it will never happen again.
Right.
And by the way, as you know, Northwestern didn't win another game until Illinois.
But was that the first game day where a big large part of the stadium was actually seat fillers? Now they have plants there to make to because I think that's the whole thing. It's like they couldn't sell out. If you can't sell out a game day game, I feel like you don't ever get to have a game day again.
The weirdest part about game day at Northwestern was that there were so many people at ESPN who had a connection to Northwestern.
Yes,
the
reason you were there.
And Wilbon and Darren Revelle and Mike Greenberg, and they all had to be on the show. I'm like going, I mean, we got a real show going on. Can all these guys find somewhere else to go? But it was pretty funny. I guess if game day ever went to Harvard or Yale, the same thing would happen.
I don't know about ESPN, but somewhere. I'm curious. Do you think there's a turnaround for the Big Ten? Do you think this is geographic trends that have set and it's going to continue to get like this, if not worse?
No, I think it's just a temporary, maybe a couple of years. I mean, Urban is a great coach. I mean, Michigan. Let's be honest. I mean, this Brady Hoke can't coach. I mean, he's going to have to go. And I think Penn State's clearly back on the rise. I don't think the two newbies are going to do much good for the Big Ten. Maryland and Rutgers. I mean, I can't wait for that game in prime time.
It's exciting.
But I think overall, though, I mean, Michigan State's respectable. I mean, there are enough good Big Ten schools that the league will have a resurgence.
All right. Well, we need Zook back. That should fix everything at Illinois. I'm curious. My last question about is about the book specifically. When you put this together, are you going to do this again? Like I know that you did some of those smaller fan books, but I know you worked with Gene on this one. Is it like I've worked with David before? I had a great experience with David. But books, man, like books, it's a weird world now. It's hard to tell what moves the needle on books or what doesn't.
I can't imagine ever doing this again.
That's frank.
And let's be honest, I didn't want to do it in the first place. I mean, I know that sounds a little crazy, but this book came to us. The genesis of the book was an article in the New Yorker magazine.
Mm-hmm.
That was done
by Reeves.
Reeves Weidman. He spent almost 6 months working on it. And the next day, I happened to be in New York for something. I get a call from a literary agent. He said, "Hey, I really would like to talk to you about a book." And I said, "Well, let's talk sometime." He said, "When can you come up here?" I said, "I'm staying at the Waldorf." He said, "I'm two blocks away." So I saw him the next day, and he said, "I got a great book idea," and it took off. And we ended up having 11 publishers bid on the book, and it was kind of the surreal book experience. But it's still one of the worst industries I've ever seen up close. I mean,
it's a mess.
I mean, I don't know how anyone in the book business makes money other than 50 Shades of Grey, because it's such a hard business, and sadly, and you know this, so few people read books.
Yeah, and it's a mess, man. I think I'll be honest. I don't want to overstep my bounds here. I think you've got a 50 Shades of Grey in you. I think you can do it.
You never know. I mean, it won't be this project. I mean, this has been a lot of fun. But I mean, I don't think I'll do it again. Now, of course, no one ever says never in this world.
Yes. So you sound pretty close to never.
I am. I did a book tour 5 weeks ago because I had to get back to work and do this network. So they let me take like 2 or 3 days off. And I went to like 5 cities in 4 days and, 3 signings, and I said, "I'm one and done. There's no way I'll ever go through this again. It's just too hard."
All right. Well, for what it's worth, I hope everyone listening to this podcast goes out and buys the book and changes your mind. You look tomorrow and you're like Amazon number one. It's the leech bump. and you're like, oh, my gosh, I didn't realize when you write a book, you get to talk to Will Leech and it sells millions and millions of copies. And so or millions more copies. And
this is the moment we've been waiting. I mean, every book waits for. Whether you used to be Oprah or the Today Show.
Yeah, Oprah, Colbert, and me.
It's the Will Leech podcast. And by the way, we're down to this. This could be the last interview I ever give.
Okay, good. Then this is your last chance. This is your last chance. You can say horrible things about David Hershey right now because I know he doesn't listen to this.
Thank goodness. David Hershey, who's the editor of this project, he listens to one person, David Hershey.
Yeah. Yeah, he is a character to say the least. All right, sir, thank you very much. I'm gonna have you. We'll sign off on this, and we'll do a brief. We'll play our fun trivia game afterwards. It's mostly college football related, so worry not. I'll explain the rules. We do this with all of our guests. But first off, no matter what, thank you for doing this. I had a wonderful time talking to you. I'm a big fan, and it was an honor. So thanks for chatting with me.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
All right, so thank you to today's guest, Paul Finebaum. You can follow him on Twitter, at Finebaum, Finebaum. You can, of course, buy his book, My Conference Can Beat Your Conference. It is available where all books are sold, and which is actually not as many places as there used to be, but still a lot of places. Thank you. This has been the Will Leech Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sun Dogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Come back tomorrow for trivia with Mr. Finebaum. Thanks.